I'm Nick. I'm an artist based at Somerset House Studios in London. I'm interested in sound and how it plays with the imagination. And I'm building a machine. Bang!
Brown and furry.
An axe cutting through a watermelon.
Fire. Peace.
The beginning.
Bubble wrap. Thundering rain.
Me.
I'm building a machine that can translate words into sounds, audible experiences. In this podcast, I discuss this idea with some amazing minds. I want to know what they think about the meaning of language, perception, and reality. I hope what I learn from talking to them will help me build this machine. Today I'm meeting the writer Neil Bennan. Neil is one of my best friends, and I've always had fascinating conversations with him about language. I particularly want to talk to him about this project because he's fascinated by storytelling, which seems to lie at the heart of language and why we need it. And he, as a writer, understands storytelling, and he has a particular interest in how stories were told by our ancestors. It's the moment you kind of look at a project that's about language, it's about everything. It's like, that's the big problem I'm having, is that it concerns every single facet of human experience, because language is not just descriptive, but it's also it determines our experience. I kind of like the idea that we don't invent words for things we don't need to talk about.
Right.
So we've only got words for things that we need words for.
But that's not completely true, because there are also things that only exist because we have words for them. Nobody has ever been killed by magic, but we still have a word for sorcery. We have a word for that, and it means something.
So that's a thing that doesn't exist outside the imagination, but it's still necessary for us to describe it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm leading on to this idea that there's a concreteness about the things that we have words for. But what you're saying is that a lot of those things are perhaps more enigmatic.
It might be useful to kind of think about what we mean when we talk about a word, actually, because we're talking about a phoneme that stands in for something else.
A phoneme is a unit of sound in a language that distinguishes one word from another, such as k, as in gan cat.
I mean, of course, we also have text, but text only indicates a spoken idea. Is that true? I don't know. Anyway, before we had text, we had phonemes that stood in for something else. These things only exist according to consensus. Without consensus, of course, they mean nothing, because you can invent a vocal sound which stands in for something in the world, an idea or an object. But if it's only yours, of course, it isn't a word. It's simply a sound that indicates meaning to you. Sorcery, for example, is at heart a means of indicating that consensus has been broken.
Why is Neil talking about sorcery?
Because it kind of requires transgression. All sort of rituals of sorcery, for example, require that something is transgressed. And generally those ideas of transgression relate back to core ideas of consensus regarding status and what's required to survive in an inhospitable environment. And it's also, I suppose, why sorcerers are always objects of the greatest fear. But at the same time, they're always people who are respected enormously for their power, literally over symbols, which is to say language and the store of myths and narratives which define a people socially. I'm sort of thinking at the moment of the way that language requires consensus to function. And at heart, its very kind of use in any community serves to strengthen the bonds between the members of any community. So it's one thing to say that without language, it would have been impossible for communities to survive in the inhospitable environments where we began as a species, as far as we know, because we needed to pass knowledge down generations and to explain that danger was approaching and all these sort of important things that you need to survive in a place where you're just a lump of protein walking through a dry place. But at the same time, the very fact of it is also born from the same sort of capacity for socialization, which, as a simple fact, is required in order for us to prosper and to make use of our other capacities.
Are you saying that language is born out of our biology as much as it is our environment?
I think it's impossible to say where the slider should rest on the final analysis of whether it's firmware or hardware. But it is the reason that we discuss it so much is because it is so emblematic of that particular problem.
And what's that problem?
The question of how much of our unique capacity with symbol and socialization and tools and all of these things, how much of that is actually simply a sort of a biological fact and how much of that is a sort of hacking of capacity. I mean, language is a hack. Sort of all the cool things that humans do, basically, it is just another one of the original hacks.
Cambridge Dictionary: three villagers were hacked to death in a savage attack. That's not what Neil's talking about here.
I mean, and in the same way, sort of the education, the bringing up of an infant is hacking, actually, because it's simply techniques of expanding the capacity of the human brain and consciousness to accommodate socialization and symbol and thereby language, as well as tool use and things.
So what is tool use?
Well, okay, well, all primates use tools. Well, like, not just primates, but crows use tools. Lots of animals use tools, but it's primates mostly who are really, really good at it. Orangutans, they use sticks to get termites out of rotten branches, and they also have culture. Of course, chimpanzees similarly have culture. So you have different communities of primates who do things in different ways, and these different ways are passed down through generations, and they're passed down through members of a community. So we have bifacial axes, for example. And this,
what's a bifacial axe?
A bifacial axe is a hand axe. It's symmetrical, but it's also the same on its reverse face. And we get hand axes, which are far, far too big to be used as hand axes. But they're made on the same pattern as hand axes, which have a certain functional utility, which is really clear. So it's really clear that tools don't simply exist for the sake of tool use.
So tools can become symbols?
Tools become symbols, yes. And
where does a tool become a symbol? Is it when it loses its physical nature? So, for example, if you have an axe and you represent it in two dimensions using ochre on the wall of a cave,
okay,
is that the point at which it loses its function?
Okay, well, it's something that exists for no other reason than its meaning, which is also, I suppose, a very good definition of art up to a certain point.
For me, what's interesting here is that it's one thing to represent an experience in two dimensions on the wall of a cave, but when we represent things with sounds, we're actually using a medium which is the same as the experience itself. So in the case of my machine, if I'm representing a word with a sound, I'm actually reanimating the experience rather than reducing it to a symbol or a message. I may be able to actually reproduce the sensation of an experience rather than delivering a symbol that represents it.
I think that the oldest evidence of something that humans have made that only exists for its meaning, I suppose, is the Blumbos ochres, which is famously a little piece of ochre found in the Blumbos cave in southern Africa, which is engraved in with sort of diagonal parallel lines on it, and an ochre palette, which has obviously been used for grinding for grinding ochre for body adornment. And there's some ochre on pierced seashells, which have obviously been covered in ochre or worn against a human body, which was covered in ochre. And these are things which only exist for their meaning. But these are tools, because these were made in a time when we were finding that cultural artifacts were materially useful to our survival prospects.
Such as, I mean, so it's such that they were involved in ceremony or...
Well, there's absolutely no way of knowing, but particularly ochre use. It does have a very, very long and very significant use in the things which define our species as a sort of symbolic species, like there's, you know, ochres in burials all over the world. All Paleolithic people used it, and some of the oldest evidence of symbolic thought in North America is a bison skull covered in ochre, and of the Neanderthals used it in burials.
So what do you mean by symbolic thought? Because I think that's are you okay?
Yes, I'm just scared of rambling a bit.
No, it's super interesting. Genuinely really interesting. I'm just wondering what you mean by symbolic thought.
As far as we know, the human capacity to allow one thing to stand in for another thing, which is at the core of language, of course.
So before symbolic thought, what was going on? We didn't have representation of things.
Well, firstly, it's a continuum. I think it's probably wrong to say there was a time when we were incapable of symbolic thought. I mean, it depends who you mean by we, and it depends when you mean by when. But if there was a mimetic component to kind of Ur language, it certainly would have been that.
What's Ur language?
To the language before what we understand as language. Paleoanthropologist Chris Knight has written quite a lot about this, and he's got some very interesting points about the kind of the economy of effort required to communicate important things if you are in, for example, a position of danger, and you need to communicate that danger is present and very, very urgent. If you don't have symbol, you have to express the danger through forceful vocalizations and movement, which is economically very expensive in a place where every single calorie is vital and might mean the difference between, you know, literally dying or not. But the moment, of course, you have the power to communicate through symbol, you can simply say, we're a bit fucked and we have to run now very fast. But of course, it is more complicated than that, because expression and gesture are things which can't so easily be distinguished as of carrying a symbolic weight or not.
But is like a scream, given that it's non-linguistic, it's not a linguistic utterance, it's a phatic utterance, is that still a symbol? Is that standing in for something?
Well, if I were to go, you know what it means, right? But if you speak a click language, like some of the still extant Southern African languages, that phoneme actually communicates as much specific meaning as any other phoneme. So we might say that is a sort of fossilized word, but simply because you and I don't understand the precise semiotic signification of that particular plosive consonant, does it mean it isn't a word? Simply because it isn't definable in any kind of dictionary or thesaurus, or even though we don't actually have a letter, we have no orthography in Western orthographics to actually kind of indicate that sound, it still carries as much meaning as any kind of word. So I'm not completely 100% sure, and I'm sure that more learned people than me can kind of explain what it is that I'm trying to communicate here a lot more accurately.
If we take the tut in English, that's a symbol, because it symbolises an emotional state.
Yeah.
So the emotional state is not symbolic. It is the kind of source.
But that's completely impossible to... That even that, of course, is because we only describe emotional states with the kind of linguistic infrastructure that we kind of inherit. So,
ah! I'm disturbed by the idea that emotions, which are so intense to each of us, are only communicable to each other through language, and that reduces their intensity to a word. So by continuation, what we're trying to build here in this project is a sort of a language system which can transform a word into a sound. So is the emotional state uncommunicable without language? The subjective experience of each and every one of us, something that is entirely private and inaccessible to anyone else unless it's communicated through language. Is language a sort of window into other people's
thoughts? There's things you do with another person you're intimate with, and there's certain very simple and very obvious biological signs of emotion, like crying and shaking and hugs and stuff. But if it's a question of absolute specificity, I think you're kind of stuck with consensus, which is a kind of a hack, but it's the best we've got.
What he's saying is that language is not perfect, but it's the best we can do with the tools that are available to us. So what I'm trying to do is build an AI which transforms words into the experience of those words.
Yeah.
So when you say bang, you hear a bang. When you say rain, you hear rain. And this depends on a sort of a concrete connection between a word and a physical entity in the world. And obviously that breaks down when you are describing something which is, as you said, not concrete. It's not a word that is a stand-in for something that exists in reality. It's a word for something that exists in the imagination, like magic, or an emotion for which we have no concrete, real object. Okay. Perhaps there's a kind of scale of concreteness between words that are representations or symbols of objects and words which are representations of or descriptions of experience.
I'm really interested to know how this project would work if it were taking one of the polysynthetic Inuit languages as a sort of, as your kind of language.
Corpus.
Yeah. I mean, a word is a sentence made up of individual phonemes, each of which communicate a particular unit of meaning. I mean, this whole thing about how famously Eskimo, there's no such thing as an Eskimo, but how famously Eskimo languages, there is 30 words or 100 words or 150 words for snow, which is complete nonsense. But it's also, as a kind of technical point, nonsense, because Inuit languages, you can't have 30 words for snow because that's not the way that language actually communicates meaning. And particularly the points where you're kind of drawing on a kind of mythical corpus as well to actually kind of communicate meaning, because you're kind of, some of these phonemes actually kind of relate to the names of culturally significant people and events which only exist in consensus and a kind of narrative level.
Let's talk about sound, because you introduced me to this idea a long time ago, that there was a point at which we started to represent ideas visually. Sound ceased to be the primary form of communication. And this is seen in the kind of origins of cave painting in the kind of upper Paleolithic period. I've always had this lovely kind of heuristic idea that was necessary because sound cease to fulfill our need as a species to carry ideas forward. Because of its enigmatic nature, it doesn't persist, and it's not transportable from one place to another, except for in the memory of an individual. Whereas visual symbols
do persist and they stay on the walls of caves. And they can also sort of later on, as they become alphabetized, can be transported from one place to another.
Yeah, in the sense that art was one of our first ways of delegating the responsibility of memory to objects.
And, like, to future, yeah, and to future, and to future people.
I mean, in the sense that our sort of cyborg nature is very, very ancient. There's nothing really new about that. All tools make us cyborgs.
In those Paleolithic times, we were limited by the physical attributes of sound, its enigma, its immateriality, and the lack of ability to transport it from one place to another. And one thing that we could do to elongate sound and kind of manipulate it and control it and observe it in a longer time frame than the present was to visit places in the landscape which exhibited interesting acoustics. Is it right to say that some of these places which were used for shamanistic rituals also have interesting acoustics?
There is a kind of a lot of evidence, a lot of discussion of the role of the acoustic of the place in designating it a place of power. In the Northern Cape of South Africa, rocking gravings have been made in places where the rocks serve as lithophones, where you can strike them. And indeed, we can see where the pattern on the rocks is missing because they've been struck with hammers. And we actually also have recordings in ethnography from the late Victorian period describing how sound was used in ritual in order to, in this case, to conjure a rainstorm that washed away the settlers' village in Victoria West.
The settlers being Europeans?
Yeah, Europeans.
Coming back round to spoken language, I wonder if language was always, given that it's a bit of a hack, a bit disappointing to us. And are there now more efficient ways for us to use language? A meme, for example.
Well, we're hacking the hack.
Yeah.
We're just hackers. We're now hacking the hack. I mean, you know, eventually we'll hack that too. I kind of rather suspect that we were, for a very long time, in awe actually of our linguistic facility, that it was itself something that was amazing to us in a way that it isn't necessarily anymore. If you look at Southern African San languages, they are extremely dense in this sort of, I suppose we'd have to call it a kind of a poetic mode. They're sort of inherently poetic. I don't want to kind of romanticise these, but they are functionally different to European, well, to any other language, in that they kind of carry a layered, polysemous, metaphorical ornateness and apparently kind of non-functional floridity.
He's talking about a language that has a decorative and ornate sound and structure.
But of course they don't, because these are the languages spoken in a place where the margins of survival were extremely slight and the environment wasn't your friend at all. And yet they seem to be complicated. Okay, I'm thinking about the lion. There's in the Xam language, it's a now extinct language in Southern Africa. You could never actually call a lion by its name, because that would be to conjure it. That would be to actually kind of bring it to you and to turn your status as a big chunk of protein into, it suddenly begins to work against you, right? So you called a lion by its respect name, and that was the thing whose shadow is night, something like that. The thing whose shadow is night. And you called it that because it was believed that lions actually had the capacity to bring about evening. It is one of their kind of magical capacities. And of course, when evening comes, you're in danger because lions can see in the dark and you can't. So you called it by its respect name. And what's kind of interesting about this is also what it tells us about the way that time was perceived, because of course time is this plastic thing. But evening was this thing which was subject to the will of a creature that had this power to eat you. And it was also, its volition was enough to actually change the environment. This is sort of time perception kind of encoded in language. This isn't an indication of superstition. It's actually a marker of the extraordinary power that language literally has to shape your survival prospects. When I say that we were in awe of language and we're talking about the kind of how a language was magical, it's because it literally was. This isn't a kind of a metaphor in the way that we kind of understand magic as this thing which doesn't really exist. But it was understood to be real, and in a way it actually was. And I think when we kind of continue to talk about this magic and we expend so many books and films and it's so prevalent in our culture, it is at heart a remembrance of the power of words to shape reality, which is why we stone sorcerers and burn witches, because they are the enemies of consensus, and without consensus we're literally dead. This is why there's no distinguishing myth and magic and time and reality, and why I can say something to you which will change your mood.
So it seems the influence we allow language to have over us is absolute.
The Statue of Liberty, standing 305 feet high and weighing 450,000 pounds. And that was going to make her disappear.
David Copperfield does this famous trick.
We constructed two scaffolding towers on Liberty Island in front of the statue and had a helicopter to give an aerial view of the illusion.
He draws this curtain open and there's the Statue of Liberty. And he closes it, and when he reopens it, the Statue of Liberty has disappeared and everybody is applauding. What he's actually done is that the camera is attached to the curtain so that when the curtain is drawn, the camera moves and the curtain moves with it. So when it reopens, it's looking over a completely different place. And everybody applauds. We've made the Statue of Liberty disappear. And this is how language is used to kill in places where survival margins are very, very tight. The person who is in charge, literally, of dispersing meaning to the community has decided to move the camera and the curtain. And to be excluded from that, for most of our history as a species, that's meant death. And that's why the person who has the power to do that is somebody who is a danger to the community. And that is how magic is real. When we talk about magic being able to kill people as a real thing, that's what it is. It is only at heart our ability, all of us as linguists, to change reality.
What he's just said is that language, for each and every one of us, language gives us the ability to change reality. That's incredible and true. Do you think it is the case that our words prescribe our experience on that kind of fundamental level?
I'm not sure I believe this. I mean, famously, in the Odyssey and the Iliad, the sea is wine dark because it's dark. It's describing a colour which didn't exist in terms of the ancient Greek word stock, because there was no, because that hue hadn't been synthesised, the pigment hadn't been synthesised.
There are many ancient languages where blue is absent from the word stock, not because people couldn't see blue, but because since then there's been an education, not of the eye, but of the mind, thus enabling a distinction to be made in language between red and blue, for example. My machine is going to listen to our words and translate them into audible experiences. So does that mean it won't be able to depict something which we experience but we don't yet have a word for? And this makes me wonder, how much of human experience do we not have words for?
I have this kind of fantasy that there is a fundamental linguistic unit which is cross-cultural and would allow us to encode a translation from a sound made with the mouth to a representational sound.
As far as that goes, like all languages and all different language types are all different kind of experiments in the production of consensually agreed specificity.
And they're contextual to the place.
Yes.
And they kind of originate simultaneously. I mean, like the idea that the root is fundamental to human experience rather than place, and that the place is global in that sense, or that human experience is global, is kind of universal. Those universal components of human experience make their way into the phonetic units of language.
I'm asking this because I'm wondering, in a very basic way, whether there is a root to the sounds we make with our mouths to mean certain things. Because if there is, that would allow me to produce audible representations of words that were perhaps cross-culturally meaningful and actually fundamentally human.
There's this guy who's been trying to reconstruct Neolithic vocabulary. And there's all kinds of people doing interesting stuff on language substrates, which is what you get when you have one linguistic group coming to a place where another language is spoken, and that language is sort of subsumed by the new language.
So languages are smashed together and recombined.
There are traces of the vocabulary and grammatic formulations and the word stock of the language that has been kind of replaced. There's some really interesting ones in Northern European languages. Weapons and sea navigation. I think I'm right in saying that north, south, east and west don't have any Indo-European roots, and words for things like helmet and sword, the etymology of these things appears to belong to the indigenous people of Northwest Europe, because the etymology of these particular kind of clusters of nouns are really super obscure. And there's some other really brilliant ones to do with Celtic substrate of modern English. The fossilized did. It was so scary I did shit myself. And did you do it? That use of this auxiliary did isn't used in any other Germanic language, only in English. The only other language it's used in is Cornish and I think Welsh. So I'm sort of kind of imagining a time where there were generations of Anglo-Saxons sort of taking the piss out of people down in Devon for putting did in everything. And I did ride my horse, did. The alveolar trill, that's a Germanic phoneme. And you know, the rhotic R, you know, that's also a Celtic sound, for example. So Celtic phonemes still persist in English.
Do you think it's possible to create a machine
Absolutely.
That transforms a word into a sound?
Yeah, I think that. I mean, I'm kind of every single time I see the new feats of machine learning, because they literally seem to be reproducing the white noise of consciousness, which is also something which we can see in all rock art. These sort of entoptic kind of grids and spots and spirals and stuff, which is what you can see yourself if you kind of excite your optic nerve by sticking your finger in your eye. These are the kind of things which present themselves to people in states of altered states of consciousness. And I'm always impressed by the way that machine learning seems to be able to kind of uncannily hone in on these particular sort of... it sort of shows us that consciousness, that there is kind of some weird thing about conscious perception, I think, which computers are going to be able to show us, actually. I think reality is a kind of a very the kind of bones of reality are things that computers will be able to increasingly are helping us sort of identify.
I've learnt lots from Neil, but above all, I've realised that language isn't designed; it's evolved, and therefore it's a hacky mess. And that means that our machine, if it even vaguely understands language, is also going to have to be a hack.
Okay, because I got this sort of weird thing, you know, that everybody seems to share the way that perception breaks down when you're taking kind of strong psychoactive drugs, I'm still not completely persuaded that that is an artifact of our conscious perception being mangled. I do wonder whether that's actually not a kind of accidental insight into maybe that it's kind of out there as much as it is in here. And particularly when I see machine learning GAN cats, those generative antagonistic network pictures of cats, I'm like, how is it? I mean, I know that human beings coded those algorithms, so of course, you know, they are going to just reflect back to us certain inherently unavoidable biases. But I do kind of wonder how much of that is actually an indication that reality is not necessarily... I don't really have the vocabulary or the kind of the reading to kind of explain what I'm talking about. But I do say that that it is an interesting thing, and I wanted to hear the next episode.
Somerset, 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 Somer